Sonics Ready podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Celtics Reddit podcast. Ben Vallis here. Thank you for joining us. I hope you're doing well. Coming up, NBA salary cap for idiots. That's a working title. This is a safe space where you can freely admit that you don't really know what the tax apron is, the biannual exception, the superannuational tax levy. See, that's not even a real thing. I just made that up. Joining us for this absolute nerd fest, Jay, aka Celtics Jay. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing well. I'm ready to hold Spoons accountable for not talking down to the folks with his fancy salary cap spiel.
Well, you're looking very much the part, so you're looking very, very fly there.
If we're talking money, I gotta look money, right? Come on.
Absolutely. And of course, the NBA CBA Oracle, at least for this evening, Wayne Spoonie. Welcome back, sir. How's things?
Things are good. I feel that we might be entering a blind leading the blind situation here. I'm really looking forward to getting some small minutia wrong and getting roasted on the internet for it. So that should be a lot of fun.
That's the internet for you.
That's right.
So here's how this is going to work. The goal is to gain a better understanding of the very complex NBA salary cap, actually known as the collective bargaining agreement. We've got some great comments here from the people of Celtics Reddit, and I'm sure between Jay and myself, some questions of our own. Wayne Spoonie has a better handle on the CBA than most, so he's going to be our salary cap Sherpa, for lack of a better term. Guys, any extra context setting or anything you want to do before we get into it? Nope.
Pray for
Spoons. All right, Celtics Jay, you want to kick us off?
Yeah, so I think the best way to start this thing off is one of the commenters in the sub Photosensitive 44 asked the question, why fans of basketball care about the collective bargaining agreement? It's like they'd rather pretend to be GMs than watch basketball being played. And I think it's a fair point to bring up here. Why are we so infatuated and in love with tearing these numbers apart and overanalyzing and critiquing and criticizing all of these contracts when there's a game that just has to get played out there? How is this stuff even relevant to enjoying this as a fan?
Yeah, so I think there's quite a few reasons. One, I think if you just want to be a knowledgeable fan and you want to know what to expect, you have to at least have some basic understanding of the CBA and the salary cap. Otherwise, you know, it's like the Twitter comments that are like, why didn't we sign that guy who's making $30 million this year when we have absolutely no opportunity? And plus, I just think the NBA salary cap is really unique in that it's bizarre. There's got all sorts of goofy rules. And unlike most leagues, almost the whole league operates over the tax. So in order to construct trades, and we'll talk over the salary cap. So in order to construct trades, there's some rules that almost make it like working a puzzle, right? It's kind of fun to figure out like, oh, if I want to acquire this guy, which salaries do I have to include? And then maybe we need to get a third team involved. So I think there's a lot of that. It's almost like a game for a lot of people, myself included, when you're looking at how, you know, when you're just being a fan, you're thinking about what your team can do and cannot do. And the CBA plays a huge part in that, especially in the NBA.
All right. Yeah. So all I hear is if you were in math club in high school and they don't meet anymore since graduation, this is a way to get involved in a community of people, you know, gather around the NBA discussion table and talk all of these finances and put together these algebraic and mathematical puzzles. Gotcha. I'm totally in.
It's a way to feel superior. That's really what I use it for.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. And yet this nerdy, I use as a lack of a better term, this sort of more mathematical approach to the game is it's becoming cool. And, you know, jocks like me and yourself, Celtics Jay, we need to brush up on this kind of stuff so that we can hang with the big kids, the Wayne Spoonies of the world. So just sticking with that, I'm very guilty of using the term NBA salary cap to refer to the whole whole thing, but really it's the collective bargaining agreement. Spoons, I think it's probably a good place to start here just by giving the listeners out there a sort of a broader sense of what the CBA is and what it means, and then we can drill down into the finer details.
Yeah, so I'll move through this pretty quick because of a boring topic. This is probably the most boring piece of it. A collective bargaining agreement is a negotiated agreement between a union and their employers. And what that does is set the terms and conditions of your employment. And that is everything from breaks to pay to benefits are all going to be contained in your collective bargaining agreement. And it's actually governed by the National Labor Relations Act, federal law, blah, blah, blah. As I said, this is all very dry and boring. But the NBA CBA is pretty unique in that, one, it's kind of fun, right? Because it's established this framework that we follow closely for NBA teams. But also, unlike, you know, your stevedores union, the NBA players very much have a vested interest in the NBA continuing to be successful and making money. And that's because of something called basketball-related income. And right now, the players and the owners split basketball-related income 50-50. And that includes like everything you can basically imagine. Apparently, the definition is 35 pages long, defining all the different things that constitute basketball-related income. Wow. I mean, it's jersey sales, ticket sales, concession sales. When they sell, like, you know, the stupid little ads that hang up there or like, this is the Ford replay, you know, built Ford tough. That's all goes into basketball related income. And probably most importantly, the TV deal goes into basketball related income. So you'll hear about when the CBA negotiations are going on, the union and the owners will get into these pissing matches about, oh, this shouldn't be included and this should be, because if it's not included in the BRI, the owners get to keep it. They don't have to split it with the players. And the amount of the BRI that goes to the players is how much money is available for player salaries and thus sets the salary cap. So that's kind of why it's important to our discussion here.
It sounded like with the salary cap and the collective bargaining agreement, and when you think of it as a whole, it's an opportunity to get a sense into not just sort of how these teams can get pieced together from the perspective of ownership and a GM executive team, but also how the fans, you know, we can actually look at this from the outside in and get a sense for what stake the players are having in the value of the league as a whole, right? So, you know, it's demonstrative of the players getting their piece of that collective pie, you know, and we're seeing a lot of investment and player participation. I mean, we've got two of our own players participating in that union leadership right now, Jaylen Brown and
Grant Williams.
So, you know, as well as obviously being relevant to how these contracts get negotiated and how that affects the salary cap for putting a team together, I think it's also, you know, a really interesting lens that we get access to at this point now that's really sort of out there, that's reflective of players negotiating and bargaining with their own vested interests in the health and the sustainability and growth of the league.
Yeah, and that's a great point, Jay, and it's actually something I think it's going to come up. One thing that I think is going to come up to your point about the players also having this vested interest is player movement and the freedom of movement. So on first glance, you think, why would the players ever want to give up freedom of movement? Well, you know, ratings are really down. And if that can be connected to this player movement and building of super teams, the players themselves have a vested interest in not driving fans away with all this movement in these super teams. So you might see something about that in the next CBA to at least limit it somewhat. I think we might see some real creative stuff. The next CBA, I think it's going to look quite a bit different than our current one.
I think another thing we're noticing right now is, whereas we've typically seen really dramatic sweeping changes across the league from a player standpoint, the last couple of seasons, we've seen a lot more of that movement at the executive and leadership level for organizations. So I think where we saw some of the, I think it'll get referred to as symptoms of the last collective bargaining agreement, which was players having more freedom to, you know, end up where they want to be and create these super teams. At the same time, it's put pressure on these organizations to be more player focused, more community enrichment, really developing a culture within that team that's supportive and competitive, right? And I think that that's ultimately only going to be good for the league. Now, is it the perfect situation? No, I don't necessarily know what is, but I have really liked seeing organizations have to make tough decisions at those higher levels without just scapegoating players.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. From the fan perspective, you almost hope that as Tatum and Brown's contracts draw to their conclusion, that there is a pendulum swing back in the other direction. Like, yes, the empowerment of players, like you said there, Jay, with organizations getting behind their players and helping them become more active and charitable in the community is great. But from the fan perspective, there is this sense of dread that, like, how emotionally invested should I become in these guys when they might be gone in a few years? And then further to your point, Spoons, like, should I buy season tickets? Should I buy a jersey? Which all contributes back to that basketball-related income. It's difficult here. Like, we've got a lot of Reddit comments to get to, and it's sort of difficult to identify the proper entry point. Like, where do we start with all of these comments? But I guess on the player retention side of things, there's a comment here from Flytanks who says, why the difference between Supermax and Max contracts is counted against the cap? It's supposed to help a team keep their player, but it just makes it harder to build a team overall.
Yeah, and I think the Supermax is something that will change, because I think that Flytanks is really striking on a point, right? This was created to incentivize guys to stay with the team that drafted them. And what it's done is just essentially handicap those teams from building competitive teams. So those guys want out even quicker. And we saw it with AD, especially, is probably the most famous example. And it's exactly those types of things that we'll see negotiated and maybe changed in the next CBA. All right. And second with Flytanks, and they've hit on what I wanted to talk about next related to the cap, and that is the actual salary cap itself. And like I said at the top, the NBA is unique in that it has a soft salary cap, and that kind of means it's a little bit meaningless. But right now, there's really three numbers that you have to know if you want to understand the salary cap. So a soft cap means you can go above it, and almost every team in the NBA functions above the salary cap. So you have a certain amount of transactions available to you if you are under the cap, and a certain different amount of transactions that are available to you if you are over the cap.
Spoons, I want to try to focus us real quick, because I think Tice159 in the sub asked the question, when is a team's cap impact taken into account? Like, can we go into the season above the tax and then trade at the deadline to below the tax and vice versa? So when you're talking about that soft cap, hard cap, how does that affect our flexibility at the different points in the season? At what point do we need to be at a certain threshold to maintain that key word, that flexibility?
Yeah, Brad Stevens' favorite word. So essentially, there's three numbers you need to know. The cap, which is going to be $112 million. The tax line, $136.5 million. And then the tax apron, which is $143 million. And that is the quote-unquote hard cap that we heard so much about last offseason. And nothing about this offseason. That's because that hard cap number does not matter unless you do a certain type of transaction. And I'll talk about that a little bit later. But for calculating what your salary cap is and whether you are over that 112 or that 136 tax line, that is done actually at the end of the season. So you'll know we have that week-long moratorium. That's actually when the NBA's, why that moratorium exists, is so the NBA's accountants can audit all the teams and the league and come up with the final number. So that's
like the time when everyone at work is like all stressed out and everyone's looking to get all their receipts in. Right. Yeah, I'm usually getting a lot of corrective action warnings around that time of the work year. Okay.
You're right. Exactly. So we are actually almost exactly one Juancho Hernan Gomez over that tax line, that $136.6 million. So if we can find a team, like, I don't know, say in Oklahoma City, to take him, a team that is under the cap to take him so they don't have to send us any salary back, we can actually sneak under the tax line before the trade deadline, and we'll be good. We won't be a tax-paying team this year. And so, sorry, go ahead, Ben.
Well, so I just want to get a better understanding of why we would do that. Like, obviously, there is a tax bill if we stay over the tax line, but we're owned by a conglomerate of billionaires, or, you know, if you aggregate all of their salaries, they're a collective billionaire. Why is it so important that we get under that tax line before the end of the season?
So, ultimately, paying the tax for 1 year is not a big deal. It's like dollar for dollar. You know, if you're $6 million over, the owners have to write a check for another $6 million. And to your point, as a global conglomerate, that's chump change, right? What the problem is our best friend, the repeater tax. And the repeater tax hits you if you have paid the luxury tax 3 out of the last 4 years. So you'll go back to last summer, or actually during this season, rather. At the trade deadline, everyone was talking about, we got to get under the tax. We got to get under the tax. And that was to reset the repeater tax, which meant that we'd be a non-tax team 2 years in a row. So we can be a tax team 3 of the next 4 years and not be a repeater team, which is important because that's closer to Tatum and Brown's primes.
Sure.
And the repeater tax, unlike the normal luxury tax, is very, very punitive. The Warriors are kind of the famous example for straight YOLO. We'll pay as much as we want. They ended up having to cut a check for $80 million for Kelly Oubre last season because they're so deep into the repeater tax. So I know that they're a global conglomerate, but writing $80 million checks is not a good way to stay as a billionaire, especially for Kelly Oubre. So it's really not about paying the tax for 1 year. It's the implications that when we want to be a contender, we don't want to be so deep in the repeater tax. We have to cut talent around Tatum and Brown when they're in their prime.
Yeah. And so Daniel Tice, I believe, was our sacrificial lamb in this case in terms of getting under the tax line, correct?
Indeed he was.
Okay. Jay, you got any follow-up questions there? I'm still mulling on the sacrificing of Daniel Tice. I hope Fongos isn't listening. What a terrible reality to have to deal with. Very confronting.
We're going
to
hear from him.
So help me just understand then, because, you know, we've touched on the idea of this soft and this hard cap. At what point can we just simply not have any more salary? So, like, what is that hard cap number? I know you gave it, but give it to me one more time real quick and just help me understand, again, that soft cap you said is at the beginning of the season. Hard cap is what we get sort of assessed on or audited on at the end of the season.
Not quite. So the hard cap actually
that's his gentle
affect
way of saying I'm the idiot. Okay.
The hard cap, no, of course not, Jay. look at that blazer, man. So the hard cap actually does not affect every team, and it's not affecting the Celtics currently. So that's the tax line. When you're over the tax line is when you get assessed the taxes at the end of the year during the moratorium. So the hard cap, aka the tax apron, only hits you if you do certain things. And that line is much like the NFL or the NHL salary caps, in that if you initiate the hard cap through a certain type of transaction, you cannot go above that number, period, at all. And you heard Brad talk about, we don't want to do a sign and trade because we don't want to start the hard cap. We don't want to be hard cap for this next season. So you cannot exceed it for the entire year, no matter what. Whereas if you're an over the cap team, you can go way over. You could go way past the tax and you can be like the Warriors and pay $80 million for Kelly Oubre.
So pros and cons to both being under or over. There's ways to sort of capitalize on either end. There's a strategy for being successful regardless of where you are currently at that threshold. Let me ask this other question, and I know that this I'm pairing with a fellow user here that asked a question, and you mentioned this term a couple times now. So user Zaytoven and I both have no idea what you mean when you keep saying tax apron. what the hell? First of all, I remember having to wear an apron when I worked in kitchens. You keep mentioning it with regards to money, and I'm getting very confused.
Surely there's a better word in the English language than apron. Like, can you explain, in addition to Jay's question, why apron is the applicable term here?
I think that was probably a very hard negotiated term in the CBA. Clearly someone really, maybe they have an apron company and wanted one of the owners.
It's a dude standing in the corner wearing an apron, just like pointing at himself like,
damn it, call it the apron, not the hard cap. I have no idea. I think it's super confusing, but the apron is the hard cap number. It's the exact same thing. And it's that 143 million. So Let me take a step back,
please,
and say, if you're under the cap, the big benefit there is you can sign free agents without worry, right? You got 20 million in cap space. You can say, hey, Evan Fournier's agent, do you want $18 million a year? Yes. Okay. If you are an over the cap team, you obviously cannot do that. But you can, and this is how teams get way, way above even the tax line. You can sign players in certain exceptions or certain ways, and there's a lot of them, right? So I'm just going to kind of walk through these, and we'll get to the reasons why the apron exists. Well, not why it exists, but we'll get to how the apron comes into play, aka the hard cap comes into play, as we go through these, because it is through off-season transactions and off-season acquisitions of players that the hard cap gets instituted. So the main way that you can sign a player is if they're your player. And that's with, named after our Lord and Savior, Lar Bird, participant in this podcast. It's called Bird Rights, right? And if a player's played for you for 3 years, you have what's called full bird rights, and you get those in a trade. So we got Josh Richardson's bird rights when we traded for him, and you can sign them for whatever you want, right? So if we're at 130 million and Josh Richardson expires while we have bird rights, we can say, we're giving you the max, Josh. I mean, we should fire Brad Stevens if he does that immediately, but we could theoretically do it. And that would have us go way into the tax and way past the apron. But we haven't triggered the hard cap yet, so we don't care. We can go way past the apron if we want. And there's also this thing called early bird rights. So if a guy's been on the team for 2 years, you can't give him a max. You can just give him 175 of his previous contract. Mm-hmm. So if he's making 10 million, you can give him 17 million. Or you can give him the average salary in the NBA, which will be 10 million next year. So that's okay. Early bird rights.
Sure.
And then there's the minimum exception. You can always sign a player to a minimum exception, depending on their years of service. So how long they've been in the league, that amount changes. So we signed Cantor on the minimum exception this past year. Next, I'm going in ascending order here, is the biannual exception. This is about 3.5. Yeah, the Bay is about 3.5 million. This triggers the hard cap. So, or the AKA the apron. So if you use the biannual exception, again, 3.5 million, pretty useless, barely above, you know, Cantor got about 2.7. You trigger the hard cap. You cannot go over 143 for an entire year, right? So say you're at 140 million and your best player is a free agent that you have bird rights on, and you stupidly sign, you know, some bum for the BAE. Say bye to your max player who's awesome, because you cannot go past that apron number.
Right.
So okay. If you use your bay, you lose your bay.
Exactly. Perfect. Exactly.
Well done. Well done, Jay. Did you happen to know when the last time the Celtics used the bay?
I don't. I was surprised they didn't use it last year because we were already hard capped due to the MLE with Tristan Thompson, but mm-hmm. I think we were so close to the tax apron that we couldn't. Right. I'm not sure the last, I know we've used it within the last 10 years, but it's pretty rare. Not many teams use it. But similarly to the Bay is the mid-level exception. There's actually three types of them because nothing's fucking easy, right? there's the taxpayer MLE, which has, you know, as long as you're over the cap, you can use this. Every team has it every year. Some type of the MLE. And that's why you'll see all these contracts for similar numbers. Like Patty Mills got 12 million. Dennis Schroeder, 6 million. You know, these are all guys getting signed by what's called the taxpayer MLE, the baby MLE, the mini MLE. And then there's the non-taxpayer MLE, which is a lot bigger. You know, it's roughly 9.5 million. That's what we used on Tristan Thompson. That also hard caps you, institutes the tax apron. And so then you can't exceed that 143 million.
From what I understand, Tristan Thompson had a tough time hiding his hard cap under his apron. I'm sorry. I'll see myself out.
Yeah. No, I mean, Kemba was, it seemed like he was with him a lot. So maybe that's why they're both gone, you know?
This is how rumors get started.
Yeah, right.
Moving on.
Right here first.
Also, pretty unimportantly, there's a third type of the MLE. It's called the room exception. That's for teams that are under the cap. So that's about 5 million. Once you hit, you have to use up your cap space. So like the Knicks signed all these players with cap space this offseason. Now they could use the room exceptions, about 5 million. So it's a little less than the taxpayer MLE.
Mm-hmm. So with regards to these exceptions, we've seen examples of this with Cantor in years prior. Now going back to 2008, when we had the championship run, the example of that MLE was James Posey, if I'm correct, yeah?
Yep.
Yeah, so, and at that time, I mean, it was significantly less then. I mean, the dollar went a bit further then than it does now, I suppose. But yeah, that MLE was somewhere around, I think it was what, 3.2 million?
Yeah, and it's interesting, Jay, that these numbers, and it's something I should have said, it's a great point. These numbers are all affected by what the salary cap number is, which is all affected by that BRI number. So you'll notice that.
So like, real quick, let's just unpack that BRI. Let's get those abbreviations out for the general. Stop giving us that fancy talk, smart guy.
It's the basketball related income.
Thank you.
That's one to remember for sure.
Yeah. And so these are all percentages or based off what the salary cap is. So to your point, back in 2008, the salary cap was almost half of what it is now. So you'll see a lot of gasps about these new contracts guys are signing. And it's like, I remember when we paid Eddie House $4 million a year. Yeah, well, that's, you know, $8 million now. Yeah, it's
relative
a lot
to inflation.
Different.
So actually, let me just throw some clarity on that. Eddie House during that championship season was only making $1.5 million, right? James Posey was at $3.2 million. Kendrick Perkins was, he just signed his extension after his rookie deal. And he was at just under $4.5 million. Ray Allen was at 16. All right. So think about the people that are making like 16 million right now. Pierce was also at just a little bit above 16. And he had kind of notably taken a little bit of a pay cut to accommodate having other stars in the team. Our highest paid player for that season was Kevin Garnett, who was making 23.7 million that year. So just to kind of put into some frame of understanding, like our championship team in 2008, our highest paid player was making 23 million a year, whereas now you've got guys like Chris Middleton's making 35. Right. So, you know, I think a little later on, we can touch on some of the other contracts that we currently have on the team. But I think looking back at that championship run and noticing the difference between how that inflation looks for different roles on a roster, it's just helpful for kind of gauging the value of the contracts on the squad. So didn't mean to derail, but just thought that might be some helpful context to add as we consider some of that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So I have a question. So these exceptions, these, you know, bird rights, they're obviously always forms of maneuverability for teams who are over the cap already. So there's plenty of options there, and you're not necessarily hamstrung if you are over the cap, which probably applies to at least the majority of competitive teams in the league. Do these percentages, do they remain relative to the BRI level or the overall salary cap? So is the MLE, for example, as a percentage of the overall salary cap, is that the same 10 years ago as it is now or thereabouts?
Yeah, I believe so. It's all pretty similar. I think the cap has almost exactly doubled from 2008, and the MLE is now about 6 million, and it would make sense that Posey was on that 3.2.
Right. Okay. There's a Reddit user, Fish, who wrote, "Let's say you and I go toe-to-toe on bird rights and see who comes out the victor," which I really, I guess, is just an invitation for that user to leave a comment in the in this post for this episode and let us know if we hit the nail on the head there as far as our descriptions or Spoonie's descriptions of all the exceptions there.
Spoons, they want all the smoke. All of it.
I know, they're coming for me. Yeah.
Yeah, well, in fairness to that user, it was a reply to a thread that I submitted to Reddit, and they probably know me from maybe listening to a few episodes that I've got no idea what I'm doing. So maybe that's where that comment came from. I'm not sure.
Oh.
Should we get to the hard cap and, you know, when does it come into play? I think, first of all, it's really helpful just to, you know, just to, again, reiterate that the hard cap and the apron are the same thing. Like, just knowing that those two are the same things and I can consolidate those two terms in my mind is very refreshing and simplifying of everything. And you can start to, I don't know, like I said, consolidate your overall impressions of the salary cap and what it means just by combining those two terms.
Maybe to feed off of that, it might be, you know, I know President Brad was user President Brad, not the actual President Brad. He hasn't yet reached out to us to supply a comment yet. But user President Brad kind of also asked a question that I think might help transition into some of these, you know, the things that you're bringing up as well, which is when the Lonzo sign and trade hype was going on strong, someone brought up base year compensations as a financial roadblock to us getting him or other types of restricted free agents. User President Brad and myself would love to hear more about that in a dumbed down format for, again, us common folk. So with regards to navigating the trade market, which of course is, you know, all the rage in the way that we consider and break down all of the different options that might be available to a team, how do we navigate that cap space and our player contracts to put together a winner with consideration to some of those dynamics that user President Brad is asking about? And again, the highlight of all that was the Lonzo Ball just drama.
Chaos. Yeah.
It seemed like every week there was a new theory on how we either could or couldn't acquire Lonzo Ball. And right down to the before he signed Chicago, we were still like, maybe we're the third team in this deal somehow.
Yeah. That was there was a lot of like, oh yeah, we should absolutely sign Lonzo, and then people chiming in, well, we definitely can't, and then people replying, well, technically we can. And partially the motivating factor for this podcast is to get down as to why or why that couldn't happen.
So I was one of those people who said technically we can, but we shouldn't, because it would cost us Evan Fournier. Look at me now. All right, well, let me take a step back. Why the Lonzo situation was so complicated, because it was going to be a sign and trade, right? And that essentially means Lonzo's a restricted free agent. That's a special type of free agent that only is someone coming off their first contract in the NBA. So Lonzo obviously is finishing up his fourth year when he got drafted, number two overall, right before Jason Tatum. So what that means is New Orleans has full bird rights on him, right? So they can offer him any contract they want. And if you're restricted, that means they can also match any offer that someone makes for Lonzo. So if someone, you might remember way back in the day, Gordon Hayward with Utah wanted a contract from Utah, and they said, you go sign an offer sheet and we'll match whatever you get, because they didn't want to negotiate with him. And he got an offer sheet from Charlotte, actually, you know, kind of weird now to think about. MJ's been pursuing him for like a decade, apparently. And he went back to Utah and said, you know, they want to sign me for $20 million a year. Utah said, okay, we'll sign you for that. And they matched it. And he couldn't go anywhere. Had to stay in Utah. So that's the kind of the power of the team with the restricted free agent. And it's to protect teams who draft players, right? To keep your guys around for a long time. So if you want to sign and trade, especially for a restricted free agent, you really got to entice the team who is signing and trading him. And so two things complicate matters. One, if you receive a player in a sign and trade, It turns on the hard cap, our best friend. It turns on that tax apron, that $143 million. So that's one downside. You lose a lot of flexibility if you receive a guy in a sign-and-trade. If you send one out, you're fine. Does not trigger the hard cap. The other complicating factor is base year compensation, which is extremely complicated, but I'm just going to give you kind of the broad strokes. Effectively, in certain situations, if you're a restricted free agent, you're getting a big raise, and you're being sign and traded, how you calculate the salary going out is different than how you calculate the salary coming in. So essentially, if you're over the cap, you have to match salaries in a trade. And that's why we always hear about, well, we could trade for Beal because we have Horford's salary and Josh Richardson's salary, right? Mm-hmm. Us and Washington are over the cap. We match the contracts. We can execute that trade as over the cap teams. Problem with problem in the very specific scenario like Lonzo is this bullshit thing called base year compensation. So for the team sending Lonzo, they actually calculate, I believe it's half of his new contract. So they would have to get back $10 million. And the other team accepting him, if they were over the cap, would have to send out 20. So they effectively would have to find a third team. So Lonzo signed for $20
million. My brain just melted.
I know. I think I'm hanging on by a thread here. Yeah, I'll just put it. Let me just put it broadly. It's not easy to match because each team considers his salary at a different number. So it's really difficult to match the value, right? Because you can't just
say. So that's why we're hearing so many of these different trade scenarios where they're actively seeking out that third team. Because really what that seems to be doing is smoothing the edges of where those numbers don't match the in and out way that teams have to navigate the salary cap.
Exactly. And but why it was so easy for the Bulls is because they were under the cap, so they could just take them into cap space. So they didn't have to worry about matching salaries.
Okay. Interesting.
Which is exactly what Oklahoma City did in that Kemba Horford swap that we executed this last year. So OKC's an under the cap team. We're over the cap. So we had to match salaries.
Mm-hmm. They didn't.
They didn't.
Gotcha.
So,
an example of what that trade would have looked like if the Celtics had pulled the trigger and traded for Lonzo Ball?
Not worth it.
It would have been so incredibly complicated. We would have had to get a third team involved, and mm-hmm. let's say his number for us is 20 and his number for them is 10. We could have sent them a $10 million player or around that number, which we didn't even really have. It's like basically Marcus Smart would be the only guy who fits that bill. And then we'd have to find another team to send out $10 million to and give them a reason to do it, right? Because they're not just going to do us a favor so we can get Lonzo Ball. So that probably costs draft compensation. That'd probably be Tristan Thompson and draft compensation. Just to get Lonzo and hard cap us because we're receiving him. So it just gets super tricky with the base year compensation. Again, very specific. Got to be a restricted free agent. Got to be getting a huge raise. And there's a couple other things that have to be met before the base year compensation rule comes into play. It's just very specific, doesn't happen a lot, but it just imbalances the salaries for over-the-cap teams and makes it super complicated.
Right. Okay. I feel like if this was a course that you took at college, like base year compensation is like the final year or the final semester of your final year, like before you graduate. It's like the most difficult possible concept to grasp in all of the CBA, but definitely worth covering. And I think you did a really good job of eloquently explaining it there. So we've covered a lot. we'll see what the people of Celtics Reddit and beyond have to say. We've covered a lot of really interesting points so far. I really like the way that you set it up like if there's three concepts that you want to grasp from the CBA, it's those three delimiting lines. So the soft cap, the tax line, and the hard cap, otherwise known as the apron.
Correct.
We haven't really covered trades. Like, I know we covered sign and trades, but there are a lot of sort of there's a lot of fine print and a lot of more complicated subtopics when it comes to trades in the NBA. Spoons, where do you want to start with that?
So I think the easiest thing to do is probably just walk through that Kemba and Al Horford trade we executed this offseason, because it hits really all the big things that you can talk about with a trade other than sign and trades. So I was sort of incorrect in saying that if you're under the cap, you don't have to match salary. That's true. But I think the best way to think about it is you're matching salary with your cap space. So we, in the Kemba Horford swap, I'm going to use round numbers here, we're sending out Al Horford to OKC, or rather Kemba to OKC. Kemba's making $35 million. Horford's making $25 million. So Oklahoma City has to make up that $10 million some way. And if you're both over the cap, that means they'd have to trade us. Talking with my hands here. They'd have to trade us someone who makes $10 million, roughly. But since they're under the cap, they can just say, well, we will make up that $10 million difference with our cap room and just absorb the difference into our cap space. And what that does is that creates a traded player exception. So that's why we got a very small TPE out of that swap, like $7 million or something like that. But like with Josh Richardson trade, we had a TPE, so we absorbed him into it. That created a $12 million TPE for the Mavericks. So TPEs are a way to make up or act as matching salary in a trade as well. And then also in that Horford Kemba swap, other than poor Moses Brown, was a first round pick. And you had a lot of talk about, oh, why did Stevens trade this year's pick, right? It's the 16th pick. We probably won't have another pick that good. And the reason, in two words, is the Stepien rule. And what the Stepien rule is, you cannot trade consecutive draft picks. Effectively, mm-hmm. you need to own a draft pick, a first round pick, in every other year.
Sure.
So if you trade next year's draft pick after this draft, that means we can't trade a pick until 2023 and then 2025's pick. And that's mm-hmm. why you see all these every, like the Nets trade, it was every other year we get the pick. And then in the off years, we get a swap. That's so the Nets could avoid the Stepien rule and own at least some type of draft pick every other year.
Oh, so that's why a lot of teams are doing that swap dynamic. I wasn't always savvy to that. So that swap is to sort of, that's the workaround.
Yep, exactly.
Okay, for yeah, the Stepien rule.
You can't just have our pick, but we will swap it with you if ours is better than yours or vice versa.
Got it. So you're not necessarily, you know, getting rid of a pick in that particular year. You're just giving, you're ensuring that the most lucrative pick is going to the team on the receiving end.
Exactly. Exactly.
Still okay. Trading value.
Gotcha. Yeah.
The Stepien rule, the origins of which are very interesting. I believe it was Ted Stepien who was the GM or the Pobo for the Cavs for a little while. Yep. And there's a really good explanation, like deep dive on that by a YouTube channel called Secret Base. I believe they used to be SB Nation. And I think it's like a 2 or 3 part series on the history of the Cavs. And unfortunately for the Cavs and their fans, so much of that is about Ted Stepien and how he like fucked their franchise for a very, very long time. And they had to introduced this rule as part of the CBA called the Ted Stepien rule to prevent teams in the future repeating history in Ted Stepien's case. So very much recommend looking that up. But sorry, Spoons, I digress.
No, that's a great point. Yeah, the real quick, Stepien was just famous for trading effectively every draft pick, usually for washed up white guys. So it did not go well for no. Cleveland and, and Ted Stepien.
So I feel like we're getting towards the end of this podcast. We've covered a lot of points. There's a lot to digest here. And I feel like for me personally, and Jay, let me know how you feel. You've helped me, Spoon, sort of develop a better understanding, a more well-rounded understanding of the salary cap, or the CBA rather. There are some concepts that we sort of inadvertently become familiar with, like the TPE, which is sort of plagued us, for lack of a better term, for the past 18 months as we've dealt with. That's kind of been like our big, like wielding big swinging dick in, as far as like how we can play in the trade market. I don't know, Jay, you got anything else you want to add to this?
I feel way more able to step in confidently to take my SATs now, at least the math portion of that. No, you know, I think it's helpful, especially for fans that maybe don't find themselves as enthused with this aspect of the game. You know, one of the things that might be worth just, again, maybe just to throw out some of that terminology that sometimes goes out there that we might not always be familiar with. Spoons, help me out with, you know, and actually I'm referencing one of our users in the sub, user Save Hogwarts, who doesn't really have a formal question, but I want to know, people always get hung up on that poison pill term. So what is that poison pill? What are they talking about?
So, okay, this is another extremely complicated concept, similar to base year compensation. So there's actually kind of two types of poison pill contracts. I think one is with like a huge trade kicker or something. I'm not familiar with that one. The one that I've always heard referred to it as was famously used by Miami to get Tyler Johnson. And so this is a very specific scenario where you've got a guy with 1 or 2 years experience coming off his rookie deal, okay? And essentially, you don't have his bird rights, right? So if he, you know, Hassan Whiteside, remember when he was on a minimum contract and got 4 years, $80 million, you know?
Yeah, that man got paid after like 1 year of being a borderline all-star.
Right. So if Miami, under the old rules, if Miami didn't have cap space, they couldn't assign him, right? They don't have his bird rights, so there's nothing they can do. So they need to use cap space to sign him. So you almost get penalized for discovering these diamonds in the rough, and then these other teams can poach him from you who have cap space, right? The Oklahoma Cities, the Knicks of the world.
Okay.
So what happened was the Gilbert Arenas provision was created, made famous by Agent Zero himself. He outplayed his 2 year minimum rookie second year round contract. And then the Warriors had no cap space and Washington offered him more than the minimum, which is all they could bring him back for. And they got him, right? They got effectively an all-star player for very low money just because the Warriors were in such a bad spot. So they created a rule, and that also created these things called poison pill contracts. So essentially, if you've got a restricted free agent, 1 or 2 years of service, no one can offer them more than the non-tax mid-level exception. So the big mid-level exception. So if we sign Yam Madar to a 2 year rookie minimum and he's awesome and the Knicks want to offer him a max contract, they cannot. Yeah, when, right. Yeah, it's just a matter of time, baby. They can't. They can't offer him that. They can only offer him that $9.5 million deal. And so we have our MLE, so we could use it to sign him. Or if it's 2 years, we'd have early bird rights, which I talked about before. So we could offer him the average NBA salary, which is $10 million. So a little bit more than the MLE. Mm-hmm. So we could match. But if you offer them more than 2 years, you can make the third and fourth year as much as you want, as long as you have cap space.
Okay.
So you could offer him $10 million, $10 million, 30, 30. As long as you take the average, so the AAV would be $20 million. As long as you have $20 million in cap space, you can offer that. And that's the poison pill.
And that's $20 million the year that you sign them. You have to have that available.
The year that you sign them. Exactly. Exactly.
So that's the wrinkle there. So like you might only get counted for the 10 on your cap for that year, but in order to actually make that deal and put it in writing, you have to have that average salary able to be absorbed into your cap.
And that's why it's called a poison pill, because do you want to match Tyler Johnson making $8 million, $25 million a year in year three, and then $27 million in year four? Of course not. So that's why it's called the poison pill. That's the poison pill. You've got this huge, you know, AAV or year to year. You get to choose if you want to have it count against your cap year to year, or you want to do the average annual value. Either way, it's way too much for Tyler Johnson, but it's a way to pry young, talented players away from teams that found them. So that's what a poison pill contract is.
Okay. A couple of misc points to get to before we wrap up. We haven't covered buyouts, which I think might pertain to the Celtics later this year, depending on what happens with, say, Al Horford. Explain, you know, I guess the pros and cons of a buyout for the Celtics, for example.
Yeah. So essentially a buyout, there's not a lot of pros other than you kind of are doing a guy a solid, like it just happened with Kemba. I think the big misnomer with buyouts is effectively you're just settling with a player to say, we'll release you if we only have to pay you this much of your contract, right? So if Kemba's making $30 million, they might buy him out for $25 million. They save $5 million. It does not affect your cap sheet, though. It does not affect it at all. You still have the cap hit of $30 million. So people are clowning the Celtics for Kemba getting bought out by Oklahoma City. They don't know what the hell they're talking about. They still eat that cap. We wanted the cap space. We don't give a crap about paying him money. So once a guy's bought out, they're a free agent. So we could effectively sign that free agent with any of the exceptions we might have available. So if we've got our BAE, if we got the Bay, and we don't mind being hard cap, we could go get, you know, someone who's been bought out with our Bay.
Bring on the Bay, baby. Can you you can buy out and stretch salaries as well, though, right? So in the case of Horford, we could buy him out, stretch it, and have a reduced annual impact to our salary cap. Is that right?
Yeah, so actually Horford's got a lot going on with his... so I'm going to pretend we pay him and he plays this year. So next year, Horford has two things going on. One, he's got non-guaranteed money. So we could either straight up waive him or stretch him for half of his salary because half of it's non-guaranteed. If we keep him on the roster past a certain date, it becomes guaranteed and we are paying him the full $26 million. So a stretch is a way to reduce the cap hit of a contract. And I believe it's you add 2 years and then just divide it by that number. So we could effectively non-guarantee Al and stretch him. So we would have like $14 million spread over 3 years, which I'm doing the math is like $4.5 million per year. And so that's why we've got a lot of flexibility. Word of the day. With that second year, that Horford contract, because it's all not only is it partially guaranteed, if we wanted to stretch, I mean, $4.5 million is a pretty minuscule cap hit in this day and age.
Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, but his potential total salary there is also a key to potentially matching for a big name trade, right? So like names that come up are obviously the most prevalent one is Bradley Beal, and his salary is the next 2 years, 34.5 and then 37 the following season. So the only way that we're going to be able to comfortably trade for that kind of salary is likely to include Al Horford's contract and then some additional players and compensation on top of that, unless we're talking about trading somebody like Jaylen Brown in that deal, which we don't have to unpack that necessarily. Like this isn't a pro or con to trade, but when we're just looking at the numbers, if we want to keep that core together, the Jays together, especially Al Horford's contract then becomes essential for targeting that potential third star, even though he's already on the team.
Oh, okay. I believe you are referring to one Marcus Smart there, Jay, just to truly
that would
get
be
that
the
open.
Smart assumption, Ben. That would be the smart assumption.
Sure it's not Aaron Neesmith?
That's enough out of you.
Shout out to Little Reddit 13 and the Smart Hive.
The Hive is alive, my friend.
Look, we're close to wrapping this one up, and if you're still listening, we've mentioned trading Jaylen Brown for the second consecutive podcast. We've hit you with an hour of in-depth CBA discussion, so if you're still on, props to you for continuing to listen.
I'm sorry.
But we do put a lot of effort into this, and particularly Spoons in this case has done a really good job of assembling all of these details and accepting us just peppering him with probably very stupid questions. Jay, we do have one remaining Reddit comment there. It's a long one. Do you want to get to this one before we wrap it up?
Sure. So this one is from So Meta. And it's a little bit of a take here, looking for insight. So I'm just going to quote straight from the comment itself. So user So Meta, it's my impression the CBA seriously incentivizes players going all the way to free agency to maximize how much they can be paid instead of extending the year before. For example, Kyrie saying he wanted to re-sign with us at the beginning of the season, but not actually doing so for financial reasons. I guess my question is just, who on earth thought this was a good idea? It makes franchises trying to plan for the future super chaotic, at least before teams could read the writing on the wall and look to trade a guy who wouldn't extend. Now you have had so many players blindside their franchise, like Durant leaving OKC or Hayward or Kyrie leaving us in the lurch. Why did it get put in this way? And is there talk of fixing it after the CBA expires in 23-24? Now that's a lot. And I think it might be helpful if we even, you know, and So Meta, please, my apologies if my reframe on this to try to consolidate it a little bit and expedite Spoon's ability to answer it doesn't totally match what you were going for. But Spoons, if you could just share a little bit about how the last CBA did kind of empower that player movement. And do you, from what you understand of how this is going and what's currently in place with the collective bargaining agreement, do you see that changing in a way that better supports franchises keeping star players or increasing the level of mobility that star players have in the league?
So I think that they're going to do something about the player movement. I don't really know what, whether that's counting a smaller percentage of supermax contracts, or, you know, requiring players to notify the team a year ahead of time, whether they're willing to sign an extension. I don't know. I think there's a lot of creative ways they could fix it, but I do think they'll do something. What he's kind of getting at, too, I think is just kind of an accidental function of how they set up max contracts. So you're eligible for different percentages of the cap for a max based on your years of service. So there's this funky thing where you're usually a 4-year rookie contract. Then you've got a 5-year contract. That puts you at 9 years. Well, if you have 10 years of service, you get more money. You get a much bigger part of the cap. That's why you see these guys signing these, like Kawhi and Paul George did these weird 1+1 contracts where they had a player option. It's so when they sign their next contract, they were 10 years of service and got more money. Mm. I just think that they were like, 10's a good number. That's even. And they didn't really think about like, well, we're heading in, you're going to have everybody expire at year 9 and they're not going to be incentivized to sign a long-term contract with their team then. So it's a perfect time for these guys to say, I'll sign a 1+1 with a new team, and then I'll extend at that number.
I see what you're saying. So players are coming in and their rookie contracts, and then their first extension only gets them to about that 9-year mark.
Exactly.
But it's at that 10-year mark that they're actually they're able to get an even higher percentage of that cap for a max salary. So if you're a superstar player, right, it doesn't make any logical financial sense for you to sign that extension year 9 when you know you're going to be eligible for a much more sizable percentage of that cap in year 10. So, right. Yeah. And I remember the last couple of years we had a lot of those one-to-ones, and I thought maybe that was just players posturing. But now that you've said it like that, I'm understanding the logistical reason why that was taking place.
So what I think we'll see with Tatum, since he's got the 4-year plus one extension, he will decline that option. We'll all be very scared. And then he'll sign a 2-year contract with a 3rd-year player option is what I think he'll do. That'll get him to 10.
Unless the CBA is renegotiated between now and then, which I believe it's up for before he reaches that point. Am I right there? And, you know, in terms of it all comes back to BRI and getting fans to spend more money and therefore generate more revenue and, you know, putting people like us as minds at ease and knowing, okay, we can emotionally invest in these players because the framework is such that they'll be around for a long time or at least be generously incentivized to do so, might lead to us avoiding, hopefully, that situation and having to read a Shams thing. Jason Tatum has opted out. Suddenly Lakers fans are piling into the sub. Yes, he's ours now. We really need to avoid that situation at all costs. It's probably
the
like
darkest
top 3
timeline.
Nah, yeah, they can just keep re-signing Rajon Rondo. That's fine.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. All right, look, that's going to do it for this one. Thanks for everyone who submitted questions. We really love that community engagement side of things. If you're listening and you have any thoughts or any follow-up questions, drop them in either the YouTube comments or the Reddit post for this episode. We'd love to read your thoughts. Huge, huge thanks to Wayne Spoonie, who put a lot of effort into compiling all of the information just shared, and for Jay for threading in all the Reddit comments into our run sheet. Guys, love your work. Thanks again. We'll be back a little later in the week with a very special guest. Until then, go Celtics. Peace.